Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.
Turning Tides is an Antics Entertainment production. You can find the show on social media at the Turning Tides Podcast on Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and YouTube, and at Turning Tides Pod on Blue Sky and Mastodon. For more information, or if you're interested in sponsoring the podcast or collaborating, please contact us at theturningtidespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Joseph Pescone, and this is Turning Tides Podcast. Today, we are joined by a very special guest. Bruce Bradley is an emeritus professor at the University of Exeter. He specializes in early flintknapping techniques, Stone Age technology, and experimental archaeology. He began his career in the American Southwest, but has since used the knowledge he acquired there to branch out into Paleolithic European and Central Asian research as well. So Bruce, thanks so much for being on the show. I've followed your work and used it a great deal as a source for my series on the ancestral Pueblo peoples, and I seriously can't express how excited I am to have you on with us today. How are you doing?
Doing very well, Joe. Enjoying retirement.
So for those who are maybe unfamiliar with your work, I'd like to just give you a moment to tell us about your career, the research you're currently interested in or pursuing.
Well, okay. We've got 60 years of archaeology to cover here, so I'll try not to get it all in detail. As you indicated, I did start my archaeological work in American Southwest with Hohokam archaeology, and that branched fairly quickly into working on Puebloan archaeology up here in the Four Corners area. But as that was going on, I was also learning flintknapping, which is the making of stone tools, and through that, learning how to use that information, what we learned from doing it, to apply to archaeological research questions. That drew me into all kinds of different things, this huge web of interconnections that happened in my research from that time. And soon thereafter, especially because of the flint knapping and the sort of experimental archaeology, as we call it, I got involved in High Plains Paleo-Indian archaeology with George Frizen up in Wyoming, and Dennis Stanford out in eastern Colorado. And I worked for a number of years on various sites and publications on Paleo-Indian sites. My work was primarily related to the stone tools. And then those connections got me involved in connections other directions. Ended up going to Europe, working with Professor Francois Bord in France, working on Paleolithic sites in France, which took me to Lebanon, where I worked with another French professor over there, then came back, ended up at Cambridge, did my PhD at Cambridge in the UK, specifically on flake stone technology experiment. And from then, it's just branched out into all of the directions. But a lot of it is based on that whole flint knapping and what we call lithic technology. And eventually, I ended up doing a lot of research independent. I wasn't an academic per se. In other words, I didn't have a job at a university. But I worked with a lot of academics and did a lot of publications with various people and some of my own as well. And like I said, one thing led to the next, and all of a sudden I'm working with colleagues in Russia, and then I'm working in Kazakhstan on projects, and it just goes on and on. My latest endeavors primarily are working here in Colorado on continuing work on the Puebloan archaeology. But I'm also working on projects with colleagues in India, South Africa, and a couple countries in South America. So retirement is keeping me quite busy, and I'm enjoying the heck out of it.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like for most people who are retired have no problem sitting back and having a martini with one of those little umbrellas in it. But you're all over the place. You're doing stuff all over the world, it sounds like, and you have your hands in so many different pots. It must be incredibly fascinating to wake up each day and be like, okay, what's today? What am I going to do today?
Yeah, it's you know, people say when they hear about how busy I am or active I am, they say, I thought you were retired. And I said, yes, I retired from bureaucracy, bureaucrats, and administration, not from life or from archaeology. And now I get to choose what I want to do. I did have an academic career as well. I was at the University of Exeter for 14 years doing research and teaching. And now that's why I'm emeritus, which means I'm retired but still affiliated.
And you mentioned your work a little bit with the Pueblo peoples of the Southwest. One of the main focuses of your career, at least if I'm understanding it right from your website, is the Wallace Great House and your excavation and mapping of this site. So it's located just south of Mesa Verde. What exactly drew you to this specific Great House as opposed to, I don't know, Mesa Verde or Chaco or Batatican or any of these fantastic, well-known tourist trap places?
Sure. Well, I started working at Wallace Great House in 1969. This is before the major Chaco project, before anybody knew about Chaco outliers or outlying great houses. I had no clue. I was an undergraduate student at University of Arizona, and one of the policies there at that time was undergraduate students weren't supposed to go and do field work. The idea was we had to get all educated before we went out and did field work. Well, I didn't go into archaeology to sit in a classroom for 4 years. So I decided I was going to get my own research project. And it happened that my parents built a place up here in southwestern Colorado. I spent the summer up here in 68, 69. Got talking with some locals, and they said, oh, yeah, there's all kinds of ruins all over the place up here. And they gave me directions to some of the ruins that were on their land. I went out and looked at them, and most of them I looked at and said, wait, this is way over my head. There's no way, you know, it's just way too much. But then I was directed to a site down here in the Montezuma Valley, east of Cortez, north of Mesa Verde. And I went out to it and walked up to it, and it was out in sort of in a field in the sage. And I walked up to it, and I just looked up, and it just went up, this big, very, very compact mound all by itself out there. So I decided that that was something I'd be really interested in pursuing, and I've been pursuing it since 1969. It happens to turn out to be a Chacoan outlier, a great house. No clue at the time. So I didn't actually choose a great house. It chose me.
That's funny. And you noticed, if I'm hearing you right, it was just like a mound of dirt in the middle of a fairly flat plain, and it looked out of place. It wasn't a natural occurrence, and that's what sort of fascinated you toward it originally?
Yeah, it's not just a mound of dirt. It's a big pile of stones and in dirt. So one of the things that we often say, and this is something that Steve Lexon used to say, he says, you know you're at a great house when you're walking along looking at the ground, and the first stone that you've seen, you look up, and then you look up. So you don't, most habitations, Pueblo habitation sites, you'll have stones, but they sort of build, you know, into a low mound, and you walk over them for a long time, and finally you sort of find the middle. The great house, you walk up to it and you look up, because they were multi-story, they were very compact. They could be quite large, like Pueblo Bonito and Chaco Canyon, but they're very compact. So the rubble is all the stuff that fell from the upper stories, and it makes a very distinctive, very discrete mound. And that's what happened to me. I was walking along, didn't see anything. There's a potsherd or two, and all of a sudden, I have to look up. It's like looking up at the side of a castle or something, except wow. under the dirt.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow, it must have been quite something to first stumble across that. And like you were saying, you had no idea that outlier great houses were even in the archaeological record.
Nobody did.
Yeah,
at that time.
So to stumble upon this, it must have been quite something. And I just wanted to ask as a brief follow up. How much of your early career was influenced by like the beatnik and the hippie movements? Because you started in 68, 69. Obviously, there was a huge new age fascination with places like Hopi and other native tribes trying to emulate this idea of.
Very little, I think I would say. I grew up in Michigan. Wanted to be a herpetologist. That was my sort of goal in life once I got old enough to have a goal. And our family moved to Arizona in the mid-60s. And yes, there was a hippie movement and all that when I was at university. Cars were being burned and marches down the streets. And I had none of that. I was out in the desert on my own, pretty much. I was always fascinated when I was growing up in Michigan and fascinated with the concept of Indian relics, as they were called. I didn't have access to any. I didn't see any except occasionally in somebody's house or something like that. But very, very quickly, I probably was 10 years old, was trying to make arrowheads. Had no clue, not a clue. Never didn't get anywhere with it either. But I was always sort of fascinated with that. And I was reading, books and things about Indians. It was way before my fascination started, way before that sort of new age wannabe kind of stuff. And I got to the Southwest where archaeology was very visible out in the desert down in Tucson. You walk around looking for snakes, you find potsherds and arrowheads and all kinds of stuff. So one thing led to the next, and I ended up going to University of Arizona in anthropology and doing archaeology.
And that began 60 years of research in the field. And I just wanted to ask about that specifically. During your excavations, your studies, your research, what is the most interesting object you personally or someone you were a colleague with excavated on a day?
Yeah, this is a question I get asked a lot. I think most archaeologists get asked that a lot. And people are wanting to hear about the golden statue or, the crystal skull or something like that. Actually, it's in a lot of ways, it's much more mundane. Some of the most interesting things that we find are things that most people wouldn't even notice. Just for example, and it's all relative. It depends on what you're working on. I was working on an excavation up in the high Arctic, northern Siberia, and the preservation there was incredible. We were finding baskets and all kinds of stuff in the permafrost, 8,000 years old. The most interesting thing I ever found on that site, believe it or not, was a human coprolite. And the reason that was so important was it was the only example we had that we could look at and see what kind of diseases people had at the time that they were living there. Okay, so the last thing you'd think would be an exciting thing to find is a coprolite, right?
For those who are not aware, a coprolite is an ancient fossilized piece of human shit.
Yeah, absolutely. And this wasn't even fossilized. It was like fresh because it had been frozen for 8,500 years.
Oh, wow.
So when they did the analysis of it, they found three different human intestinal parasites. As an object, in terms of its scientific value, is incredibly important. As far as finding something exciting, probably the most exciting thing I can think of at the moment was a site up in Wyoming I was working on with George Frizen and a crew. A mammoth kill site, actually a mammoth meat cache site called the Colby site. And we excavated this thing for a couple months in the summer of, I can't remember, 75 or whatever it was. And we uncovered all these mammoth remains, and we found no stone artifacts. We were finding nothing in terms of stone artifacts, and it was one of the hardest digs I've ever done, because it was in bentonite, which is a really nasty clay. Very, very difficult. When it's dry, you can't, it's like concrete. When it's wet, you can't, I mean, it just sticks to everything. So it was a very difficult dig, and we got all the way down to removing all of the mammoth bones except one, which was a scapula. And George took this and put it in plaster, and we took it off, and there was this little pedestal of dirt or clay underneath that. And he took his trowel, and I was just watching. He took his trowel and just knocked that down, and out came this beautiful red Clovis point. It just sort of flipped through the air. And, I mean, I still get goosebumps when I see that point flying through the air. So that was an exciting find for us.
That's incredible, because that sort of like vindicated the kill site. It gave evidence to what you believed the site was, which is a pretty
absolutely
impressive.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
How old was that site? Do you mind me asking? Or do you remember?
Excuse me?
How old was that site around?
It's about 13,000 years old.
Wow.
Which is a sort of a typical Clovis age. It might have been more like 12,800. I can't remember the exact dates that we got off of it, but it fell within that Clovis era quite nicely.
Wow.
And now I'm doing another project in Wyoming. So, so comes full
circle. Do you want to go into some details about that project?
I can mention it. Yeah. It's a really interesting project. It's in southeastern Wyoming at a place called Sunrise. And what we have is a prehistoric, very early red ochre mine. Red ochre is a red pigment that was used for many different things in the past. A lot of times it was used in ritual. A lot of the Clovis, the very, very early things, the Clovis materials that we find are sometimes we find caches of amazing big spear point kind of things that are coated with red ochre. And so this is a mine, actually, where they dug a trench into the side of this hill in a very iron-rich area, and they were actually mining red ochre. And the projectile points that we found associated with that are all what we call Paleo-Indian. They date from about 13,500 to about 10,000 years ago, and then we don't see any more use of it there. So we're investigating this, as far as we know, unique North American red ochre mine.
Wow.
In terms of its time period.
I was just saying ochre, if I'm not mistaken, was used a lot in like the Middle East and like Turkey tens of thousands of years ago. Am I
everywhere?
Incorrect?
It's
everywhere.
I'm working on a project in South Africa, and one of my colleagues down there has been studying ochre and the intentional use of ochre going back 300,000-400,000 years ago.
Wow.
So it's a real human thing to use red ochre, and particularly, it has its own functional things. You can use it as a sunscreen. You can use it for preserving wood. You can use it for preparing hides. There's a lot of practical things. But generally speaking, when we think of it in archaeology, we think of ritual contexts, burials, caches, you know, special offerings that tend to be associated with red ochre. Neanderthal burials sometimes had red ochre with it. So it's something that goes way back. So it's a real universal thing, but to actually be able to find and investigate one of their mines that's so old, is a real exciting project.
Yeah, that is very, very interesting. I was not aware of an ochre mine in North America. So that's truly some groundbreaking information you've given us. So returning to Pueblo space, to the Southwest, and to the great Puebloan era, Pueblo III, etc. Arguably one of the great, you know, pull factors which influenced the Great Abandonment, which occurred sometime between 1250, 1350, is the Kachina phenomenon, the Kachina religion, the Kachina cult, whatever you want to call it. From what I understand, it's very hard for archaeologists to find physical evidence of pre-Columbian Kachina worship. So I was wondering, from an archaeological point of view, what are some of the indicators that this religion took hold during the Great Abandonment, or are there? And was there significant change in Pueblo lifeways?
Boy, that's a that could take up 5 or 6 hours all by itself.
That's its own podcast.
Yeah, we'll try to do it fairly in less. yeah, we use the term Kachina phenomenon, Kachina religion, Kachina cult sometimes, that has a very, very specific expression archaeologically, but not up here, in the Four Corners area. Where you see it really well developed is down in the Rio Grande and all the way down into Mexico, northern Mexico. Starting in, say late 1100s, early, all the way through the 1200s. And some of the ideas that other people have come up with, some theories, as well as myself, see an influence up here beginning to take effect somewhere around 1200 AD. So this is just within 100 years of the Great Abandonment, as you called it. And we don't see all the iconography that usually we see with a full-blown Kachina. In other words, iconography meaning rock art that shows Kachina masks and things that are recognizable today as Kachina. But we do see changes in the organization. In fact, very dramatic changes in the organization of the way people were living together on the land up here. And that starts really about 1200 AD. And really the big change is right about 1250 AD, when we see whole areas of the landscape that were previously occupied and farmed left. People moving into cliff areas, tops of canyons, sort of accumulating aggregating into these communities, sometimes with enclosure walls around them, sometimes in very inaccessible places, lots of towers. There's a real major shift in the way people are living on the land. They're probably still farming the same places, but they're not living all spread out in small homesteads anymore. And that's got to indicate something major. And there's any number of theories. And your first podcast, I think you covered a number of those. So I won't go back into all of that. But I think we have a very, very good example of and this is one of my theories, and not, I'm not alone on it, but I developed it, I think. We have what's called a cultural revitalization movement. This is an anthropological concept that was developed by an anthropologist back in Pennsylvania in the early 1900s, mid-1900s, when he was trying to explain the changes that happened in Native American societies and with European contact, because that was a major disruption of culture, as we know. And how did people react to those disruptions? And one of the ways that people reacted, according to his ideas, was to actually intentionally try to change their culture. So we often think culture change as being a slow process. It happens because you're adapting to different environments, et cetera, et cetera. But this is a different concept. This is a concept where people living in a culture, society, actually come to realize that the stresses that they're facing are no longer tenable in the society that they have, and they have to intentionally change their own society. Mm-hmm. So this is an intentional process, and it's very well developed by Wallace, Anthony Wallace. And when I read about this and I was thinking about the archaeology of Puebloan people, I thought, well, that might explain some of these things, these major changes, like the rise of Chaco or the Kachina or any number of things that sort of happen suddenly, and they're so different from what you're seeing at the moment that they happen. So I applied this concept to the work up that I've done up here, specifically starting with Sand Canyon Pueblo, which was what we call Pueblo 3 site out west of Cortez here. And that was my project that I worked on for 9 years in the field. I used Sand Canyon Pueblo as sort of the example of an expression of a revitalization movement. Now, these revitalization movements happen because of cultural stress. Now, the stress can be environmental, it can be social, it can be political, any number of things that stress people to the point of, to the breaking point, basically. Mm-hmm. And we do see the depopulation of this whole area by the 1150, 1170, when there's a major drought here in the Southwest, which really affected the way people could live on the land. But it didn't mean that they had to change their culture. It just meant that they had to adjust to the environment. And then around 1200, then specifically at 1250, we see a major, major shift. And it's a shift that it wasn't easy. It meant a huge investment in changing villages, moving different places. We see a real emphasis on a ritual and the ritual and symbolism, et cetera, especially at a place like San Canyon Pueblo. And that goes on for about 25 or 30 years, and then it just crashes and burns. And I can mean that almost literally. It comes to a very abrupt end up here, and people leave the area. I know a lot of living Native Americans don't like the concept of abandonment. They don't like us to use that term. That has to do with our society, where abandonment gives you salvage rights, basically. So the Pueblo people that I work with and friends with, et cetera, talk about this area as being left. They migrated out of this area for various reasons, but they didn't abandon it. They still spiritually are here. So I try to avoid the term abandonment. Now, we do have archaeological evidence that some places were, quote, abandoned. Sand Canyon Pueblo was left very abruptly, probably overnight, after a major violent event. And that happens to correspond pretty much with people migrating out of this area, this whole region. So anyhow, the Kachina, getting back to the Kachina, where does that come into all of this? Well, I think the Kachina is the way Pueblos are organized around. And the Kachina is just the expression of that organization. It's very communal. And what we're seeing in previous times up here and in a lot of the areas of the Pueblo world, we're seeing the organization is more at the community level, the family level, the clan level. We don't see a highly organized central authority. Chaco may be an exception. But generally speaking, people were sort of living in small hamlets, communities, interacting at a very low level of complexity. But on the other hand, what we call Kachina, these Pueblos are organized and they face inward. They don't face south, they face inward. And the central plaza is the major area. And it's really more of a communal system. So the concept is, rather than family and clan being first, community comes first, above and before family and clan. Now, that's a really significant change in the way you view the world and everybody in it. So definitely, that's what I think we're seeing that's happening. And I think the stressor up here is this Kachina, or this what I call a communalist organization, is happening down the Rio Grande. It's moving outward from there into the Hopi area, Zuni, coming up sort of north. People up here have kin down there. They're interacting down there a certain amount. But there's this great no man's land at that time called Chaco. Chaco is no longer a place of major activity at 1200 and 1250. And I think the people up here go through a revitalization movement, and that's usually initiated by and sort of organized by a prophet, a person that comes forward. A society is ready for a new way, and a person comes forward with visions, usually a young person or sometimes two young people, comes forward with visions and says, everything's gone to hell in a handbasket. This is how we get it right. I had this vision that the spirits were telling me what to do, and they become a prophet. And this is what Anthony Wallace was identifying in so many of the Native American groups that as they came into contact with Europeans. And there's some very well-known ones. The Ghost Dance is a really good example. A couple young boys, basically teenagers out in Nevada, had these visions about how they could make society, their society better and Native American society in general better. And that spread. And so the Ghost Dance is actually the Sundance is still around. Another one that's very, very well documented is the Tecumseh episode, if you want to call it that. It was a revitalization movement orchestrated by a fellow by the name of Tecumseh Shawnee. And he basically almost pulled it off. He bringing tribes together, people together, the traditional enemies together to rise up against the European incursion, Euro-American incursion. Most of these revitalization movements fail. They don't make it. And it's primarily, there's reasons for it, but primarily it's because the prophet has prophecies. And if the prophecies don't come true, then he's discredited. And usually the whole thing falls apart.
To make them work, you need like really long.
Revitalization movements tend to last a generation. And then fail. There's been a few that haven't. I think the Kachina might be exactly one that didn't fail. This new communalist organization is still here 700 years later. So that may be one that made it. So what is the archaeological evidence of all this? Well, again, that's a little hard to explain in a few minutes, but I have published an article on this. All of my research is available. Everything I've published is available on researchgate.org. Just look up my name and you can get all the articles and publications and speculations, et cetera, et cetera. And that's where I have a publication I did, I can't remember how many years ago now, which is proposing a revitalization movement that failed. And it failed very dramatically up here. So that was a long answer to a simple question.
Hi there, Editing Joe here. During this part of the interview, there was a touch of technical difficulties, and the interview takes up right in the middle of my question about flint knapping and what first inspired Bruce Bradley to pursue it.
I think I indicated earlier that just as a little kid, I really wanted to know how to make arrowheads. I wanted to try it. I wanted to do it. Tried various and sundry things. There was nothing to find out about it, nothing to read about it. There's no instructions. There wasn't YouTube, none of that. So I just tried off and on as a kid and never got anywhere with it. I never gave up on it. And when I was a teenager, family took a trip in the American West from Michigan. One of the places we stopped was Colorado, and I saw some arrowheads in a gas station. And so the arrowheads were made out of obsidian, which is to me a very exotic stone. And so for the first time, I actually got a connection between the stone and the artifact. And so I convinced my parents to stop at a rock shop, and I bought a piece of obsidian. And then at the next campsite, I proceeded to pulverize it into little fragments. And that was kind of the beginning of my knapping career. I made a heck of a mess. Got cut up pretty bad, too. But anyhow, and I didn't do any more until I got to the University of Arizona. And one of my professors, Art Jelinek, who was working with François Bord, who I later worked with as well in France, who was a flint knapper, which means somebody making stone tools the way they were made in the past. Professor Jelinek brought François Bord to the University of Arizona for a semester, and he was showing flint knapping, and that was it. I just skipped every class, and I just sat down and flint knapped with him for a whole semester, basically learning the process. And once I got started, it was just, I was compulsive. I couldn't do anything but flint knapping. So that's kind of how I got started. And then there were other students there that took it up. And eventually some of those, two of them specifically, sort of became lifelong colleagues. They went their own separate ways. I went my way, but we still managed to get together off and on. And flint knapping became something that a lot of academics realized was useful to understanding the Stone Age bench. 99% of human history is archaeologically expressed only in stone tools. So if we want to know about where we came from, we got to understand those things. So people started to realize the value of this particular approach to science, archaeology, as well as a hobby. It's a great art. It's an art form as well. And so I've been doing it ever since. When I actually started teaching it, you know, we get together and flint knap together. We learn from each other, but I didn't actually do courses or anything like that until I got to the University of Exeter in 2003. I guess it was 2003. And I became the head of an experimental archaeology master's program. And so in that program, we did a lot of teaching of all kinds of different ancient technologies, flint knapping, pottery making, iron smelting, bronze smithing, you name it, we did it. Ancient types of fishing, hunting, farming, buildings, et cetera, et cetera. So I managed to maintain, that kind of a process and actually used it in flint knapping some major research projects as well. Since I retired, I've been doing a lot of knapping workshops for academics primarily. I've done three in China, a couple in India, mostly in South America. And so I've been teaching it now probably for 20 some years, 22 years, something like that. And still using it, still applying it, still learning new things, learning from other knappers, teaching other knappers. It's a fascinating process.
It sounds so fascinating because the little bit I've read about it, at least specifically with you, is when you spoke with David Roberts in the 90s and how you taught, if I'm not mistaken, you taught flint knapping to the Jimenez people?
To who?
To the Jimenez?
Oh, Jimenez.
Jimenez.
Actually, no. No, it's Zia.
The Zia,
I had a workshop at Zia. Oh, gosh, I don't know how many years ago now, quite a few years ago. And I had a group of Zia guys and some Hickory Apache fellows. One or two of the Zia fellows kept it up for a while, but didn't really take it on in a big way. It's really important, the whole issue of arrowheads, as we call them, Histiani and Zia. It's very, very important in ritual. They're considered to have power and protection. And since they don't make them anymore, they had to rely for a long time on just finding old ones. I got involved with the Zia people in early 1980s when I did an excavation on the reservation with Zia workers. And they got fascinated with my making of arrowheads, and they needed them. They needed a lot of them. And so I was making lots and lots of arrowheads for Zia, as well as sometimes Jimenez and other people. And I've got another workshop now planned with Zia sometime this year, maybe this summer.
Wow.
It's now become a new generation, and there's some young Zia people that are really keen on learning to do more than just take a little flake and turn it into the shape of an arrowhead. They want to know how they really are made. And so I'm looking forward to doing that particular workshop later this year. But mostly the teaching that I've done has been focused not on making things, but learning the process and getting the skill. Because until you learn the process and understand it, you can make outlines of arrowheads or any kind of artifacts, but not something that really represents what was going on in the past in most cases. Mm-hmm. So when I do a workshop, a 4 or 5 day workshop, I'm not really focusing on making something. I'm focusing on learning a skill. And it's been very, very successful. I've got flintknappers all over the world now that I've inspired to take it on, specifically for academic purposes, but also some are doing it as a hobby, some are doing it for artistic expressions. So
it seems like a therapeutic exercise to knap flint. Is it? Because it's like, it's a very, you know, you get what you put into it.
Yeah, it's organic. I mean, and stone isn't organic, but it's an organic process. And when I'm flint napping, first of all, it's great for taking out frustrations because you can hit that rock as hard as you want, and it doesn't hurt anybody but yourself. So sometimes that helps. But when I'm frustrated, I don't really do very good flint napping. But it is it's almost a contemplative process. When I'm sitting down, let's say I'm going to try to replicate Clovis Point, which is very complex, and I have to do it the way they did it, not just any old way, to so that I end up with something that looks like one, but I have to get my mind turned around to thinking the way I think they thought. So when I'm sitting there doing it, I'm thinking in concepts, not in language, and I let myself sort of disappear in a way from what's around me. And I'm sort of focused into what it might have been like in their heads 13,000 years ago. So in that respect, it's a way of connecting with the past. Of course, I can't prove that I'm doing it exactly the way they did it or thinking exactly what they thought. But certainly the concepts and the choices I have to make fall into a realm that's closer to them than it is to what we do in our daily life here. So, So it's sort of a meditation.
Yeah. Yeah. And I could definitely understand where that comes from. So, switching gears a little bit here, I understand you're currently involved in a massive project, which is attempting to prove that America was populated by people who had lived in southwestern Europe during the last glacial maximum, around 22,000 years ago. This theory has since been dubbed the Solutrine hypothesis. Am I saying that right? Solutrine?
Solutrine, yes.
Solutrine hypothesis. How is that research going, and are you able to tell us about any discoveries you've made in this area?
Well, yes. And definitely that's one of the research areas I've been involved in for 25, 30, 40 years now. It's something that I'm not directly researching right now. It's time for the next generation to take it on. The other thing I want to say is we're not trying to prove it. It's a hypothesis that we're putting forward. And when I say we, late colleague, Dennis Stanford, the Smithsonian, he and I were the ones that we didn't think it up. We actually took it on as a piece of research. It had been pretty much rejected, the idea of a connection between what is now southwestern Europe and the Americas, that had been pretty much just flat out, no way, Jose, it couldn't happen, so don't think about it. Well, Dennis and I came at it from different directions. I came at it from working in southwestern Europe on materials and in North America on the Clovis. Dennis worked on the North American Paleo-Indian. I worked with him in Colorado in the early days. But he also worked in Alaska for off and on for 30 years trying to find the origins of what we call the Clovis culture in North America, which at that time was thought to be the first. The idea was people came over from Siberia as a culture, ready, full-blown culture, and populated all of the Americas within 1,000 years. That's the Clovis first concept. But the evidence just didn't seem to stack up for either Dennis or Sarai. He coming at it from working in up there in Beringia, which is that area between Alaska and Siberia, for all those years looking for a possible ancestor. And me working in southwestern Europe, not looking for a possible ancestor, but running into all kinds of things that pointed that direction. And it was Art Jelinek, again, a professor at Arizona, who first proposed this concept, saying, well, this stuff looks a lot alike, but then rejecting it and saying, you know, his conclusion was it was just convergence. Two different peoples in different places managed to come up with the same general solution to do things. So it just looks a lot alike, but it's not related. Dennis and I felt that there was a lot more evidence to be looking at. So we started that back in the early 90s. He and I got together on this and sort of seriously. And as you will indicate in your next question, it's very controversial. Huge blowback when we came actually produced the hypothesis. We always said it was a hypothesis, not a solution to the world. A huge backlash here, specifically in North America. We tried to publish some articles, but the peer reviewers and the journals wouldn't even look at it. Eventually, we did get a publication in World Archaeology in 2004, but we presented it, our hypothesis, to a Congress in 1999 called the Clovis and Beyond Congress, held in Santa Fe. I think it was Santa Fe. Anyhow, we were soundly rejected, to say the least. And so we kept working on it, and we were, that rejection didn't discourage us. What it did is it gave us the impetus to actually do more research and really look at evidence and look at evidence that people weren't even looking at because it can't happen, so why look for it? And during the same time, there's an awful lot of things that were going on in archaeology in the Americas that indicated that people were here before that Clovis culture. So what we call pre-Clovis or older than Clovis, most of which was also soundly rejected with very little scrutiny. No, it can't be. Mm-hmm. We know what happened. So therefore, why waste your time looking at it? But over the same years that we were looking at this possible connection between southwestern Europe, and I've got to make it very clear, we're not talking about Europe as we think of Europe now. It's a geographical space. Southwestern Europe and specifically North America, as we were doing that, this whole Clovis and older than Clovis was going on. And the more that's been looked at and the more sites that have been brought forward, now there's very few archaeologists anymore that ascribe to the Clovis first concept. So people came from different places, different times. Our hypothesis is just one possibility, and it's not necessarily the oldest or the only. In fact, we make it very clear that we know the evidence is very, very strong that people did come from Siberia and through Beringia. Possibly not in time to be Clovis. Possibly that happened a little later, although some fairly recent discoveries up in the northwest coast of North America have found some materials that don't look like Clovis in any particular way, but they're definitely older than Clovis, and they're up in that part of the world, and they do look like they might have come from either Japan or that part of East Asia. So we're not denying or suggesting that people didn't come from Asia. We're just suggesting that people, the evidence seems to be fairly strong that people came from other places and a lot earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I'm involved in that, but It's not my main thing these days.
That's fair.
We do have one site that, again, I've just been sort of marginally involved with. A fellow by the name of Darren Lowry has been the one that's really pursued these a number of sites that have been eroding out and being exposed in Chesapeake Bay area, Delmarva Peninsula on the east coast of North America, and very, very strong archaeological evidence. A site, specifically one called Parsons Island, has produced a fairly significant assemblage of artifacts. And the context is dating to about 22,000-23,000 years ago. Mm. It's very clear that the dating is good. The context for some of it is really good. Some of it's out of context, but associated. And if you took that group of artifacts and you stuck it in southwestern Europe on the coast in Spain or France or what we call Basque country, nobody would question what it was. It would, of course, be what they call Solutrean. This is a Upper Paleolithic archaeological culture that's very distinctive. And it's perched right basically in the Pyrenees and right on the coast. And so that's where we think a group of people originated. They, during the last glacial maximum, things were tough on land, and they started to look to the ocean and the edge of the ice to get their food, and eventually expanded their territory to include the North Atlantic and ended up finding North America. They weren't set out to find North America. They didn't all get in boats and migrate to North America. We think they expanded their hunting territory, learned how to exploit that North Atlantic ice edge during the glacial maximum at various times. And then as the glaciers retreated, things warmed up. The sea ice didn't come annually anymore. They quit coming back and forth. And so a population ended up being isolated on the east side of North America. That's basically the concept. We published a book in 2012, University of California Press, called Across Atlantic Ice. And all of our evidence that we had up to that point in time is in that book. And we think it's very compelling. And although we've had, as I indicated, quite a bit of resistance, specifically in North America, but also, interestingly, in Spain. Some of my colleagues and Spanish colleagues are not very keen on the idea.
Very interesting.
I've given presentations on this. Besides publications, I've given presentations on this hypothesis almost everywhere in the world now. China, Russia, all over Europe, Central Asia, Africa, South America. And generally speaking, most archaeologists, we get a fairly positive response from them. They say, well, your evidence is really compelling. We may not buy it, but you got some pretty good evidence. It's worth looking into. And when you have a hypothesis, that's what you're looking for. You're looking for people that are willing to say, well, we need to look for more evidence. We need to figure out if the evidence you have is good. We need to figure out if there's evidence that we're missing. How does it apply? Does it support the hypothesis? Does it contradict the hypothesis? And that's all we've been trying to do. We've always been, and I'm speaking for Dennis, he's gone now, but we've always encouraged people to critique our evidence. And some people have. More often it's just, I don't like it. I don't think it could happen. They couldn't have had boats. And so therefore I don't even want to look at your evidence. We get a lot of that. So, we can't let that discourage the investigation. So anyhow, that's where we are with that. And I'm, again, like I'm saying, I'm not actively pursuing new evidence. There's some great stuff that needs to be looked at. We've had opportunities and then had them sort of rug pulled out from underneath us, specifically looking on the continental shelf off of eastern North America. Wow. Some very intriguing materials that keep getting dredged up off the continental shelf out there. Mm-hmm. But it's very, very expensive to do the kind of research. And unless one has a compelling reason for somebody to invest in that kind of research, it's not going to get done. So hopefully, as evidence keeps accumulating and maybe the hypothesis gets shifted a little bit here and there based on new evidence, that's the way it should work.
I think the way that you get funding, Bruce, and I'm just going to run this by you, you need to go to, you know, whoever, Elon Musk. I assume he's in charge of what's whatever this is.
Yeah, he's trying to cut back on funding, not give more.
So this is how you get him to give you some money, okay? You need to say that they actually used lithium to, as all the tips for their tools. All the tips of their tools were made from lithium. And if you fund this, you will have you'll get a good 70% of the lithium we discover.
Yeah, well, I'm not into that. It's a good idea, but I think, you know, we Dennis and I and Darren and a number of other people actually had a project all ready to go. We had everything set up, and the only thing that we needed was the remote operated vehicle, the unmanned submarine, which was voluntarily donated to us to use by a federal agency to go out and re-find a mastodon that was dredged up off the bottom of the ocean. We were just waiting for the weather to clear, basically, and then some of our colleagues published an article in one of our journals that basically claimed that we made up our data and it wasn't real. And somehow or another, the head of that agency found out about it. I can guess how they found out about it. And that Rove was retracted. So we lost our research project.
Wow.
And that's pretty disappointing, not because we lost our research project, but something like that could happen actually in what we call science, where somebody accused, and it was libelous. I mean, we could have sued them because they basically said we made up our data and we could demonstrate absolutely fundamentally that we hadn't. And this got published in a peer-reviewed journal. Wow. So that's kind of discouraging. It didn't discourage us to stop looking, but on the other hand, you know, coming up with a couple $100,000 to do a piece of research is not the easiest thing to do, especially when the people that sit on the committees don't like what you do. So, you know, it's part. I've learned a lot about how science doesn't work sometimes.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. It's usually beholden to big money interests, unfortunately. Your level of discovery.
Yeah, this wasn't even so much follow the money. It was just people that just didn't like the idea and therefore just said it's not worth investigating. Don't want to put money into it. So that has been one of my major undertakings, and I'm still sort of on the focus of the receiving end of criticism. I wouldn't call it criticism. And fair enough, I it doesn't matter to me. I don't have to prove anything to anybody. So
yeah. So as you were saying, there's an intense amount of controversy surrounding this this hypothesis.
Again, in North America, with a certain group of people.
Yeah.
Most of the places I go, it's not that.
And it is like somewhat understandable. If you hear just this theory at face value, your brain can very easily spiral into the horrors of colonialism in the 16th to the 19th century, which undoubtedly occurred. Millions of people died as a result of this horror show of slavery, of all of this. And I think this is where people's brains go when they actively criticize you and your theory. And they've said really wild stuff. They've called you a white nationalist. They've called you every name in the book. And it's completely unfounded because
we were published racists. We were flat out called racists in a letter from a colleague to the Guardian newspaper.
I read that article and I was like, this is completely unfounded. They haven't, it seems like they didn't even read your data, or if they did, they cherry-picked it to such an extreme that it wasn't even your hypothesis anymore. It became some race-baiting thing, which was incredible.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's kind as of I was disappointing.
Saying, it's really disappointing because it's a fantastic theory and it makes a lot of sense when you understand like genetic flow, like the R1 strain of DNA is present today in many Taino people in Puerto Rico, for example. And this has been postulated to be from the original Vikings from 1100, 1000, whatever. But otherwise, people have said maybe it's the Solutrean people who came here and gave their R1 DNA to the people there. I'm quoting.
Yeah, we've got, there's a lot going on with genetics. And that's out way outside of my realm. That's why we collaborated with Stephen Oppenheimer, who's a geneticist at Oxford. And one world-renowned geneticist, and that's where we learned about X2A and RY1B, et cetera, I can't even think of all the terms now. There's a huge amount of genetics that have been done since our book came out, and there's geneticists that absolutely flatly say there's no way that there could be any connection, and other ones that saying, look, here's this evidence, this works, It's all, again, a matter of almost opinion. Genetics right now is, it's going to be very, very important in the future. But for this particular topic, it's kind of a red herring in the sense that we have no Solutrean genetics. There's one tooth that might be Solutrean that produced some genetics. We have no Clovis genetics except for one possibly Clovis-related infant bones from Montana, and the genetics in that person were not indicating a European origin. And the conclusion of the geneticist that wrote that paper with the archaeologist was that this proved that people couldn't have come from southwestern Europe. One sample in bad context. So right now, There's great hope from my point of view for genetics to either support or contradict our hypothesis. But the idea that we know what was going on in the past based on genetics, I mean, they just found whole new genomes just last week. You know, I mean, it's a developing discipline with methodologies are developing. We've got genetic information of populations that have no archaeological expression. So what do we do with those? Et cetera, et cetera. So I'm letting genetics flow, so to speak. Let it happen. Let's see what happens. The geneticists don't agree with each other. And again, it's a very young discipline. We have very, very small sample sizes when we're looking at ancient DNA.
Yeah, very little exists in terms of, you know, human DNA or like wood that remained from tools or any of this.
Yeah, preservation is our greatest challenge. The older it gets, the less preserved it is, pretty much. But new genetic techniques are coming up with genetic material from, 300,000-year-old things, etc. So there's a lot of promise. But
definitely,
until our sample size gets to a point where, it actually has some meaning, statistical meaning, the way we get our big sample sizes for genetics in terms of human populations are modern populations. And then that's projected to the past or vice versa. But everything's so mixed up in modern times, it's hard to get ancient DNA. But we did... One of the aspects of the research that we did, I think, is really important, is collaboration with Native Americans, with indigenous people. There are indigenous people that are very, very interested in their past and their distant past, and they do see science as a way of seeing some of that past. It doesn't explain everything. We did a project a few years ago. We did a documentary for CBC, Canadian Broadcasting Company. And they allotted a certain amount of money for DNA testing of human remains from Canada. And this was at the request of Native Americans, not scientists, who wanted to collaborate with us to look at some ancient DNA of what might be their ancestors. They had their own issues that they were looking to resolve, which weren't the questions we were looking at. But together, we partnered and analyzed 40 teeth, all of which came from contexts that were pre-European contact. We're talking 1,500 years ago and older. Okay. And out of that 40 individuals, in terms of the mtDNA, that's the mitochondrial DNA passed down through the female line, four of those individuals had X2A, which is a Western Eurasian haplotype that mutated in North America.
Wow.
About 18,000 years ago. So you either got to bring people all the way from Western Eurasia, i.e., quote unquote, Europe, all the way across Siberia with leaving no markers, all the way to Eastern Canada in prehistoric times, or simply across the North Atlantic, one of the two. So we think North Atlantic is a much better explanation. So again, it's not just science. It's what you do with the findings. And, you know, evidence is evidence. It's not truth.
Yeah. And it doesn't prove like that Europeans were destined to conquer the new world with fire, blood, and germs. It has nothing. It has no bearing on Europeans as we understand them. I mean, these weren't even Caucasian people or Indo-Aryan, if you want to be. They weren't even close to the continent then.
No, that's a Neolithic. Most of what we see is racial expression is Neolithic and afterwards. So we don't have Mongoloid people or Caucasian people 20,000 years ago.
Yeah.
So that's a red herring. It's just irrelevant.
So I spoke with Steve Lexon several weeks ago about the Southwest. And he specifically believes that archaeology should be taught as a history as opposed to a science. And specifically, he uses the capital H, history. What is your opinion on how the field of archaeology should be classified and taught?
Okay. I've been fortunate to have two different backgrounds. I had the background of being taught anthropology, archaeology here in the United States, which was taught through anthropology, a social science. And the other background was at Cambridge, and archaeology in that part of the world came out of the natural sciences, geology, geography, etc. So there's two different ways of looking at it. Archaeology is a history. I mean, it's a history based on evidence of physical things. But the way you find out about those physical things is through science. So I don't think it's one or the other. I think that the focus on science has sort of dehumanized it sometimes. And with this sort of the hubris that we know what the science is telling us in terms of how people are or were. On the other hand, if we just want to talk about history, then are we talking mythology, legend, history? History is, what is history? What's it based on? So Steve and I have had many of these discussions, and they're always lively, and we always get along just fine. He's one of my heroes, Steve Lexon, for Southwestern Archaeology. He's always thought out of the box, which I think is really important for making progress. Sure, you come up with ideas that don't float and they just don't go anywhere eventually, but that's fine. How else are you going to make progress? So I would say it's not one or the other. It's got to be both. But by emphasizing the science, sometimes we lose the people. By doing history, we can ignore the science. But the science is what archaeology is based on.
So yeah. I think that's Steve's main gripe is like he wants the humanity to remain in history. He doesn't want it to just become this like baseless or not baseless, but he doesn't want this to be a cold, unfeeling discipline where the human story is not exactly glossed over, but maybe it's not as emphasized as it should be.
I totally agree with, and I can give you an example. When I was at University of Arizona, it was the era of what they call new archaeology, or it's now called procedural archaeology, which was really, really based on natural science. The whole idea that there's natural laws that determine what happens in the universe and et cetera. So it was very environmentalist determinist. So people did this because the environment changed. They had to adapt to environmental situation, which basically takes free will and out of the equation, which is what people are. Okay. And everything was based on natural laws. And this is how we're going to interpret archaeology is through natural laws. That dehumanizes it completely, from my point of view. Then that eventually evolved into what post-processual archaeology and modernist archaeology, whatever you want to call it, things like phenomenology. How does it make you feel? You go out and you sit under a tree and you pretend like you're in the past, and then how does it make you feel? So you got these extremes. So I was sort of taught in both of these approaches. I'm kind of in between both of those. But we're working at the Wallace Great House for all these years. The evidence that we have from there, we're trying to answer certain questions. And some of these questions are very human. And some of these questions are more sort of general. And archaeologists have been asking a lot of questions. How do they make their living? This is one of the basic things we do. What was their subsistence? What was the environment like? Did the environment affect their subsistence? You know, these kinds of questions. They're all important. They're all useful. But they sort of cut out that humanist sort of, what were people thinking? What were people doing? How did they behave? How did they react? How were they as people? And this is where revitalization movement, that's not based on the environment per se. It's how people behaved, how people made decisions, how they changed, how they did things. Now, a lot of the things that we're looking at, the evidence that we have at the Wallace Great House, we're starting to see really strong evidence of things like ancestor veneration. Now, ancestor veneration isn't a science, right? This is how people thought about their existence, how their worldview is. And we have, but it's through the scientific and careful recording and processing of context and based on assumptions and hypotheses. What does this mean? What does that mean in terms of things like ancestor veneration? We're looking at development of house societies. Chaco and revitalization of house societies from Pueblo Bonito at Wallace Great House. And this is when I talk to my Native American friends, my Pueblo friends specifically, this is the stuff they're interested in. Mm-hmm. They say, we know what we ate. We don't need to know what we ate. We don't need to know that there was a drought. We all know there was a drought. So what do we want to find out? We want to know, were those our people at Wallace? Or were they another people? Did they think like us? Did they do what we do? Could we identify with them? And so we look at ritual. We look at things that would be considered non-functional. It's not just a matter of making a living and getting from one year to the next. It's how do you live with yourself and with your community? So in that respect, I definitely agree with Steve. There's been a huge amount of emphasis on just sort of the natural sciences. But without the natural sciences, the rest of it's just speculation and dreaming. So there's got to be a coming together of those things. evidence is based on our science. How we interpret that science is another story.
That was a great answer. Wow. Very, very awesome. So as we finish up today, is there anything else you'd like to touch on or address that we haven't yet before we wrap up our talk?
Oh, gosh. There's so many different things. The one thing that's so interesting about archaeology to me is that it's something that every human being has something to contribute. I worked at a place called Crow Canyon Archaeological Center for a number of years when I was excavating Sand Canyon Pueblo, etc. And we worked with the public. So people would come and work with us on our sites to help us with excavations. And I also set up a Native American advisory group. So we had input from Pueblo people on the research that we were doing and all that kind of stuff. And the one thing that came across was archaeology is about learning about the human experience. It doesn't matter when or where, right? It archaeology is based on physical evidence. So it's not the written record, it's the physical evidence. And everybody has a human experience, right? Everybody's experiences in one thing or another, many, many different things. So the one thing that excites me about archaeology is you start talking to people, no matter what their background is, and the idea of where did we come from? Who are we? Always comes to the fore. And how do we know that? How do we know what we were 300,000 years ago if we don't do archaeology? So I guess to me, a lot of people say, well, what's the value of archaeology anyhow? You know, who cares? Well, I think almost everybody cares at one way or another. Not everybody cares about the past. I've known people couldn't care less about what happened 3 years ago, much less, you know, 300 years ago. But generally speaking, there's this curiosity about who we are and where we came from. And if we don't do archaeology, it's pretty much just made up. I mean, speculation.
We may as well be like sacrificing goats and reading their gallbladder for signs at that point.
Probably, yeah. But even that's a human experience, you know? So
true. That's true. Yeah.
So anyhow, I think that's about it. I mean, we could talk forever and ever on all these different things.
Yeah, this has been such a cool talk, and I just want to say thank you so much for being on the show and for sitting through the technical difficulties we had at the beginning. I'm sure that people are really going to enjoy hearing your perspective, and I know that I have. This has been a great conversation for me.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to express some of my ideas.
Oh, of course. Anytime you feel like coming back on, even if you just want to like vent about the state of the world or something, you're completely free to send me an email, and you're totally welcome back. And I just want to say thank you so much. It's been a real honor.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you. And thank you, everybody, for listening. I hope this has appealed to you as much as it has appealed to me. I'll see you next time. Thank you.
If you like what you heard today, you can support us by donating on PayPal at Turning Tides Podcast 1. We would also appreciate it if you take the time to rate and review Turning Tides on whatever platform you use to listen, and share the show with your family and friends. It really helps us bring the show to more listeners. Thank you so much for the support, and thanks again for listening.